Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Before we get to the first interview today, I gotta warn you, this interview contains mature subject matter and relates to an ongoing criminal case. In this segment of our show, we'll hear another case of interest from Kate Jean Corbett Pollock. So last time you told me a little bit about the Erica Parsons case. What are some of the others that you've researched and have had a profound impact on you?
Mm-hmm. It did. It did have a profound impact on me.
So are there any other cases of this nature that you want to get the word out about?
Yeah. One of the cases, I write about a lot of cases. There are many cases like this. Once you start researching this and keeping an eye on these cases, you might be surprised how many of them there are. One of the cases we saw recently that was all over the news was the Turpin family in California. They were a homeschool family of 13 children, and that was a pretty big story. The children were kept chained to their beds and starved. Many of them were so malnourished that they had growth stunting, and they appeared to be minors to law enforcement, even though they were actually in their 20s. A lot of these children were grown up, and they were still being kept in the house. Some of the children were minors. There was quite an age range. I think it was 2 years old to around 27 or 28 years old for the oldest adult child. Law enforcement thought that the older children were 10 and 11 years old because of how small they were from years and years of starvation. And they were quite surprised to learn that they were actually grown adults. In the state of California, there's no homeschool oversight. It's the same kind of thing as the Erica Parsons case, where in North Carolina, I mentioned how easy it is to start a homeschool, where her mother, her adoptive mother, just needed an email address. It's pretty similar in California. That might surprise people because it seems like a progressive state, but really similar to a lot of other U.S. states in which there's very, very little regulation. So the Turpin father was able to start a homeschool. It was called the Sandcastle School, and nobody ever looked into it. Made sure the children were being educated. It was just that easy.
So
these children were really under the radar for a very long time and were horrifically abused until one of the children, who was 17 years old, escaped through a window and was able to find help. And that's when law enforcement came to the house and discovered these horrific circumstances and took the children away from their parents.
So
that was a really big case that came out of California recently. But other cases, they don't get the same sort of news coverage. That one was particularly heinous, and it was a good media story, I think, because all the children, there were pictures of the children, and they all had matching outfits on. Their parents were seen with an Elvis impersonator in Vegas with all the children doing a second wedding. It was weird. So I think that lended itself well to kind of a fascinating media story. Because some of these other cases don't have those kinds of bizarre elements, and I hear about them because it's part of my work. And at least once, sometimes two or three times a month, there's a homeschool homicide or child torture case that comes on my radar.
So a lot of these homeschools are essentially just a front. You'd mentioned there were instances of fraud and misuse.
Fraud is very common in these cases. Quite often with cases like this, especially when the child is disabled, there's been an adoption involved or some sort of disability money like SSDI that the family is getting. Like Savannah Lecky was a recent case that happened in Missouri. Savannah Lecky was 15, and she had ADHD and autism. She was adopted, and her adoptive mother, I guess, was having some kind of challenges. The story is that her mother's new boyfriend was abusive and did not want to have to put up with Savannah. So the family sent Savannah to live with her biological mother, Rebecca, in Missouri, very isolated in the rural area. And you see this kind of isolation in these cases quite a bit. Either it's isolated in a really rural area, or the children are just kept in the house all the time. They never go outside. The Turpin children never went outside. They were only allowed outside at night. So you see extreme isolation in these cases. So Savannah was sent to work on her biological mother's farm. And very shortly after her arrival there, her mother started severely abusing her. She was frustrated with Savannah's disability and eventually ended up drugging her, beating her, and burning her in a fire pit. And Rebecca was caught very quickly. Law enforcement did a great job with this case. You know, they figured it out very quickly, and justice was served. People were sufficiently outraged. So that was the thing that happens sometimes, is that people think that autistic people are violent. And really, autistic people are victimized. Autistic children are victimized at higher rates than the rest of the population.
So
it's not unusual in these cases for me to see somebody, a child, especially when they're coming of age, if they're 13, 14, 15, that seems to be an age when a lot of these children are murdered. And I'm not really sure why that is. That's something I want to continue doing some work on. But I do see that Erica Parsons was 13. Some of the other children were also around that age, 13, 14.
So in terms of homeschooling and children with disabilities, what sorts of safeguards would you recommend that be set up just to prevent this sort of thing from continuing?
What really needs to happen is that it needs to be harder to set up a homeschool. That's one thing that needs to happen. It should not be this easy. It's very, very easy in almost every state in the United States to pull your child out of school for no reason and just put them in a homeschool, register your homeschool with the state. Sometimes people don't even bother to register and nobody knows about it. That's happened before in some really severe child torture cases. So there's no oversight on a lot of different levels. So starting a homeschool with just an email, that shouldn't be allowed. That shouldn't happen. You should have to have some oversight, some regulations around that. Is the child really being educated? There needs to be some testing. Also, if a child is disabled, somebody needs to know about that. Sometimes people recommend Department of Children and Family Services being alerted. In most of the cases that I do, DCFS has been well aware of the abuse for a long time and nothing happened. So I don't think it's enough to just let DCFS or a child welfare reporting agency know about this stuff. There needs to be a wide variety of stops involved. And one of those things is for the child or children to see a mandated reporter, a doctor, especially if the child has disabilities. The child needs to see, you know, if it's an audiologist or if it's an orthopedic surgeon. You know, that needs to be looked at because that's medical neglect, in my opinion. And a child should, especially a child with hearing loss, which is personal to me, should have speech pathology, American Sign Language, or whatever type of sign language taught to them. So there needs to be some system in place. Are these children getting that kind of therapy? Are they getting that kind of help? Are they seeing a doctor? Are they actually being educated? And also there needs to be regulations around homeschool. So once you have a child in homeschool, in these cases, years, decades, a decade goes by, and nobody's even checking to see if the kid's been educated at all. And in these cases, they're not being educated. That's not the point of the homeschool. This isn't like a regular homeschool where the parents are good people and they really want to educate the kid. This is just about exploiting legal loopholes. It's not about homeschool. That's just a cover for the abuse. And it's a good cover, and a lot of people are taking advantage of that cover. And they wouldn't be able to take advantage of it if it was harder to do.
So Would you recommend any new safeguards as far as disability funding goes to make sure it's actually being used for the child?
Yes, that's kind of a tough one. American Disability Law, the Americans with Disability Act, that covers, supposedly, it's supposed to cover everybody in the United States that has a disability, and that includes children. But it's a complaint-driven act. It's not enforced. So you run into a lot of problems with that. When a child is in a homeschool, their parents have the right to, I don't think it should be a right, but right now, the parents are allowed to decide whether or not that child gets disability supports at all. Hearing aids, orthotic, wheelchair, whatever it is. If a child is in public school, it's the law that that school provides those disability support. You know, I went to public school and I had to have a speech pathologist. You know, I had to go see audiologist. That was, and I was also, you know, registered with the state as a disabled child to get the funding because it's expensive. So the state covered all of those services for me. You know, that's the kind of thing that all children should have. But if they're homeschooled, they just fly under the radar of all of that stuff. So there needs to be some sort of system of reporting. The Coalition for Responsible Home Education, which I'm a part of, we have a lot of those policies outlined on our website, and we talk about those sorts of things in more detail. I don't think it should be the decision of the parent whether or not their child gets disability services. It's the child's right. It's the child's right as a disabled person to receive those services, and it should be enforced, and there needs to be an enforcement mechanism in place for that.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
These tragedies may fall under things we as a public don't want to know, my friends. But they are things that we must know. Because if a child loses their life or is being abused because of their disability, or for any reason whatsoever, we as a people have to take notice. We have to stand up and say, this is unacceptable. These are beautiful, potentialed, capable lives. And yeah, it's not quite what we expected. Life is never what we expect. If you take on the responsibility of a disability, you take on that responsibility. That is to say, to nurture their growth, their development, and hope someday that they make the world just a little better than it is right now. That is not something to be mistreated or misused or exploited for personal financial gain. These programs and services exist to allow the child to thrive and have their basic needs met, not so the parents can go on a Hawaii trip. They exist so that this child can and should have the potential to explore their own life's capabilities. And we must be there for them. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Delta Zetas are some of the most devoted students at the University of Windsor. Our sorority is built upon four pillars: academics, sisterhood, philanthropy, and leadership. We are known as successful women on campus and leaders within our community. Right now, we are looking for amazing women to join our sisterhood. For more information, check out Delta Zeta on Facebook.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Kate Jean Corbett Pollock about another case of tragedy involving a child with a disability who was homeschooled. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Denny Olivier will be telling us a little bit about his background in mental health, and specifically, narcissism as a mental health disorder. So tell me a little bit about your mental health work.
Okay. Well, my name is Denny Olivier. I'm with Mind Your Wellness. I'm the owner and the educator. I facilitate small and large groups and do presentations on mental health. My background is in psychology and philosophy, and I have multiple certificates like the psychological health and safety. As for the work I've done, I've worked in the military as a medic. I worked in crisis work. I've worked as case managers with people with mental health and addictions. I've worked as a public educator for the community and corporate trainings.
So when you mention your background in psychology, I'm interested to know a little bit about how narcissism can be a mental health disorder. How can it affect people around the narcissist themselves?
Right. So you're asking about what narcissism is, or how does it affect the people around them?
Both.
Okay. Well, narcissism tends to be focused on somebody who has a sense of grandiosity, seeing themselves bigger, more important than who they are, but also they tend to have a dominant, trait where they try to control other people around them. And when other people are getting, say, attention, they like to try to belittle others and try to steal that attention back. Those are just some, traits. And how does it affect people around others? Well, it in a lot of ways, it can have people walking on eggshells. It can hurt people's self-confidence, self-esteem. They can personalize everything because they are constantly hearing negative comments. And also, they may not even be able to engage with the person in a positive way.
So, might a person who has narcissism tend to exaggerate or romanticize some of their past events, looking back through rose-colored glasses, so to speak?
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
Would a person with narcissism tend to look back at their life and exaggerate and put things in grand terms?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, they always want to, the most common situations, they do want to see themselves or at least present themselves as being better than what the truth is. Now, not to politicize anything, but Donald Trump would be a great example of somebody who has traits. I'm not diagnosing him, but when he has criticism, he will attack somebody instead of listening to that. He will tend to exaggerate everything, never saying sorry, because that lack of empathy is also part of narcissism. And the people around tend to feed into that by always changing their behavior to fit the narcissist, to always appease them. Right. So
what would happen if someone, for example, shattered the illusion, pointed out that what they're presenting as fact might not necessarily be the case?
Well, then there's nothing wrong with that, in the sense that as long as it's not affecting other people, or it doesn't disrupt, what the need is there. So, for example, if somebody keeps saying, you know what, I'm like the low person on the ladder, but yet everyone treats me like I'm the CEO because of how hard I work. Well, it doesn't mean anything. So what? But if it's actually affecting the workplace and the sense of entitlement, the expectations of others, the aggressiveness takes place, then that could be a problem. So just because somebody has that grandiosity doesn't necessarily mean it's a problem. It's only a problem if it's affecting that person's life and others. More often than not, it does affect the other person, the narcissistic personality. The person who has narcissistic personality is affected often with depression, anxiety, and other factors that affect them. At the same time, it affects other people around with conflicts, by again, creating that unhealthy environment.
So how do you suggest that people go about keeping a cool head when they're faced with someone's presumption of superiority? What can we do to keep from making it into an all-out issue with this person?
Well, the first one, the first thing that people can do is not personalize. Really saying that, again, this is the other person's opinion, not my opinion, and really trying to put that boundary in. Other things would be to make sure that they state what their expectations are or how they feel to the person who has that narcissistic personality. Another way, which seems deceiving, but it can work, is just changing the language, how we talk to somebody. For instance, if I want to say to somebody, you know what you're doing is hurting me, I can change that and focus on, you know, when we do this, it's amazing. I really feel good, and it makes me want to be around you. Unfortunately, when you do this, it makes me not want to be around you. So what you're doing is you're saying you can get the attention and the interactions if you do this, but if you do that, you're going to lose that interaction. And that is a risk that people with narcissistic personality do not want to take.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Oh, awesome. No worries.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Annette Sims from About Face. So what can you tell me about the recent happenings with About Face?
Well, About Face recently has actually gone through a ton of changes, super exciting ones. We have been able to connect with the children's hospitals across Canada, and we have also started to really make a focus towards more mental health-based programming. So we are actually starting to explore programs such as mindfulness, as well as programs within our camp surroundings, and the our core program of Camp Trailblazers, being able to look at developing coping strategies and all of those types of things to be able to allow for more growth and development and be able to promote a more positive mental health outlook. So there's definitely that change that's happening within the programming, and so far the response has been amazing. We've been hearing from lots of parents and the children as well as adults that are affected by facial difference, and everyone is giving us extremely positive feedback, and we're able to reach more and more people. So presently we are, I believe we've reached almost triple the number of people that we have reached within the last 2 years combined. So we're definitely growing, definitely moving at a really fast pace, but it's definitely a positive change for sure.
So when you mention mental health for those with a facial difference, I can't imagine that having one and having society look at you differently simply because of that does wonders for someone's state of mind. So How do you go?
So when it does come to mental health itself, we are aware that there are a lot of barriers within the community, as well as stigma when it does come to the appearance of the face, right? Because someone does, that's sort of the first thing that you see when you go and you look at someone, and people are often judged by their appearance. So being able to focus in on really being able to maintain a more positive outlook, and also allow for individuals to build skills, life-based skills, such as public speaking and employment readiness, those types of things, to be able to help with their confidence levels, really sort of has a core impact with how individuals are able to really manage their mental health But we do also recognize that, it's the weight isn't solely on the individual impacted by facial difference. Within the general population, being able to sort of fight the stigma and the stereotypes that are out there, similar to individuals with disabilities, with those experiences that they face, we really sort of take on the education component and really work to educate the external population and the general population as a whole to make sure that they understand that facial difference is really just another form of diversity. And to be able to educate individuals about diversity and inclusion really helps to bring home the fact that, the weight of the mental health component doesn't just sit on the individuals impacted by the facial difference, but it is also within the population itself.
So, in your time with About Face, have you experienced any success moment that stands out for you?
I think one of my favorite moments with About Face thus far is actually speaking to parents. There have been a number of times that I've been able to go and speak at Family Day events and other sorts of events that occur across the country, working with various hospitals, children's hospitals. And a lot of times the experience that parents have when a child is born with a facial difference, they do feel very overwhelmed. They're not really sure what is going to be coming. It's the fear of the unknown. So for myself, I've really found that the biggest success has been to be able to not only speak with those parents and connect them with adults and teens who have facial differences to sort of see the different possibilities of what their child's future may look like, but also be able to, whether it's within a camp environment or just within a sort of a public setting, making peer-to-peer connections, really seeing that parents are thriving by going and connecting with each other and really creating a support system that they had previously been unaware that existed. So, that's probably the most positive thing that's definitely come out of my time with About Face thus far.
So, if you could send any message to the community about why it's important to include those with facial differences just as part of the community, what would you say?
That's a very big question and has definitely lots of components to it. But I think in general, it's really not to judge a book by its cover. Individuals with facial differences are people just like everybody else. And there are a lot of times that individuals with facial differences are often stereotyped or judged or sort of thought to be incapable of certain activities or to have a disability of some sort. And though they do have a difference, they may not actually have a disability and may not need support. So it's not something that they should be treated any differently. People may look a little bit different, but hey, you and I look different, right? So really just being able to treat everyone the same way, no matter their appearance.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
For sure. Thank you so much.
This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.